supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A crime that triggers a slap on the wrist for a U.S. citizen can mean much harsher penalties for non-citizens. It can even lead to deportation. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner announced a new policy today aiming to change that.
The new policy is modeled on one used by the District Attorney's Office in Brooklyn, where prosecutors take immigration status into account when deciding how to charge or offer plea deals to defendants. Philadelphia DA Krasner says the idea is to make sure non-citizens who commit low-level, non-violent crimes are punished but won't be deported as well.
Sometimes you will find that serving a short period of time in jail will not get you in trouble with immigration, but having a long probation will.
To carry out this policy, Krasner has hired Caleb Arnold, a former criminal defense attorney now practicing immigration law. Arnold says things like a minor drug possession conviction can have steep consequences, even for long-time legal immigrants.
That conviction can deport a lawful permanent resident, and there's nothing you can do to fight it.
One way to prevent it, but keep the same criminal punishment, is to tweak the language prosecutors use in the case.
Maybe it's just a little change in how we craft the plea agreement that preserves relief.
That can turn a deportable offense into a non-deportable one in the eyes of federal immigration enforcement. This new policy also makes good on a campaign promise of Krasner's to, quote-unquote, resist the Trump administration by cooperating with federal immigration authorities only the bare minimum required by law. In a statement, U.S. officials with Immigration and Customs Enforcement said they'll continue to work with Philadelphia officials and their law enforcement partners to uphold public safety. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
A pay raise for state employees and a $100 million boost for capital projects makes Delaware Governor John Carney's spending plan very different from last year's bare-bones budget. Details from WHYY's Mark Eichmann.
What a difference a year makes. Delaware's financial situation is very different as Carney presented his second budget proposal to state lawmakers. Last year, the state faced a $400 million deficit. This year, Carney's plan would grow the budget by 3.49%.
This is a budget that makes Delaware stronger, focuses on making our state more competitive, addresses some of our critical needs in supporting the schools in our state, and does it in a sustainable way.
The budget includes a 2% pay raise for public school teachers and a $1,000 pay raise for state employees. Carney said it's the right time to support state workers.
We're competing with private industry. We're having a really difficult time on the correctional officer side. A lot of our employees are really underpaid relative to the private sector.
For the current fiscal year, the state expects to take $100 million more in revenue than expected. Carney's budget plan would move that surplus money into the new budget to fund one-time items like infrastructure and economic development. He expects convincing lawmakers to go along with that idea and not use that money in the current fiscal year to be one of the toughest fights ahead. Republican state senator from Southern Delaware, Ernie Lopez, applauded the governor's approach.
I think this is the year that all 62 members of the General Assembly need to be fiscal conservatives. And I really say that on the fiscal point. And that's it. So we need to focus on the dollars and cents and make sure that we're finding value for taxpayer dollars and know that the work that we are going to be doing this year is going to really be important going forward.
State lawmakers have until June 30th to approve a budget, a deadline they missed last year. From the Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy signals a break from his predecessor's reliance on tax incentives with his selection for the state's Economic Development Agency. Joining me with details is NJ Spotlight's John Reitmeier. John, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
So what is the role of the Economic Development Agency?
It's an agency that's affiliated with the Treasury Department but isn't a part of it. It works with small businesses to help them secure finances. It works with bigger companies that are seeking tax incentives from the state. More recently, was used by former Governor Chris Christie to secure financing for projects, including the State House renovation that's ongoing right now.
But it's those tax incentives, some $8 billion worth over Christie's two terms, that draws the most attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was one of the major issues of the Christie administration. These tax incentives, so I think if Christie had his druthers, remember, he was a Republican working with Democratic lawmakers, he would have wanted lower taxes across the board. That wasn't going to happen. So the next alternative was to create incentive programs that sort of put New Jersey in the game when it came to competing with other states for either attracting a big company to locate in New Jersey, or what we often saw after the Great Recession was maybe companies deciding to leave.
So these incentives are not grants, right? They're breaks on future tax bills.
That gets missed a lot. New Jersey has, when it comes to these types of programs, maybe some tighter restrictions than other states do. It's not a blank check. The companies have to meet certain requirements or hurdles in order to redeem their tax breaks.
So how is it determined that these incentives give you the bang that you want?
Well, and that's the big question. There was actually a study done last summer by an independent consulting firm that took a look at New Jersey and specifically the economic incentive programs. And it suggested that New Jersey is actually providing more than many other states per dollar per job for these incentives, and that the state could probably get a bigger bang for its buck, so to say, by investing more heavily in programs or policies that nurture startup and small business companies. There's more upside in terms of stimulating the job market when you're working with these smaller companies that could grow into a big company than when you're just, say, keeping a company in your state by offering incentives. And so that's actually been one of the big issues that the new governor, Phil Murphy, has been raising as he talks about things like the economic tax incentive programs and the EDA itself.
So let's turn to Bergen County native Tim Sullivan. Tell us about his experience and what that might portend going forward.
Currently, he's working for the administration of Governor Donnell Malloy in Connecticut, working for that state's Economic Development Agency. And prior to that, he worked in New York City during the administration of Michael Bloomberg, also on economic development issues. So there's a two-part feature of this nomination. One is that he's an outsider. So Phil Murphy has said he wants a new culture at the EDA. Well, certainly bringing in somebody who sort of has all his experience from outside New Jersey would help to establish that. But also, he has a background in sort of economic development. He's worked for both Connecticut and New York in a similar role, though not in a leading role. And so that kind of breaks from the pattern, at least toward the end of Christie's administration, where he would select people who were members of state government or maybe were lawyers, but not necessarily specialists with a resume of economic development. Here you're bringing somebody who's doing this type of work right now in the state of Connecticut.
When will New Jersey residents understand whether this change in culture has dividends?
So for all the lucrative tax incentives that were awarded, New Jersey's unemployment rate, and if we want to measure the economy and say maybe that's one of the metrics we should look at, is still higher than the national average. And though there's been a lot of improvement since the Great Recession ended, the growth rate in New Jersey's economy has lagged that of other states. And so one of the questions has been, how effective have these incentive programs been? And Murphy's actually ordered up an audit of them.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
NJ Spotlight's John Reitmeier on NewsWorks Tonight. Last night, hundreds of volunteers took to the streets of Philadelphia, part of the annual national effort to count the number of people who are homeless at the coldest time of year. This year, the city paid some volunteers to help with the count. Those who've experienced substance abuse issues, mental health diagnoses, or homelessness. WHYY's Nina Feldman tagged along with one group.
It's midnight, and Team 1A is bundled up, caffeinated, and ready to hit the streets of Old City and Penn's Landing.
Because I know one of us has to also do a paper tally. Does anybody want to volunteer for this?
I'll volunteer.
Okay.
That volunteer is Monique Taylor. She has experienced being homeless in the past, which is why she's here today.
I didn't seem to understand that my addiction and my mental health issue were like a hand in the glove.
Taylor says that kept her from getting help and made it hard to get off the streets. This year, the city offered $72 stipends to volunteers like Taylor to help with the count. During her team's rounds, Taylor approached some people outside a Wawa near Head House Square. One of them agreed to answer the survey questions.
And where are you going to sleep tonight?
Somewhere underground.
Okay, so would you say at the subway?
Yeah, subway.
The point-in-time count is mandated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development in cities across the country to get a coordinated snapshot of the nation's homelessness. Liz Hirsch heads the city's Office of Homeless Services. She says that with the opioid epidemic, they're expecting to see the numbers go up.
But we need to know. We're not sticking our heads in the sand. We're going to look at this crisis straight in the face, and we're going to try to do everything in our power to address it.
Last year in Philadelphia, the city counted nearly 5,700 people experiencing homelessness, making it 10th highest in the country. This year's numbers will be released in March. Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
The rate of opioid-related deaths and overdoses has rapidly risen in Pennsylvania in recent years. It's a crisis that's having spillover effects on young children across the state. As some kids experience trauma and neglect during critical years for development, educators worry about how they'll later cope in school. For Keystone Crossroads, Kyrie Greenberg reports on an early intervention program in Allentown. It aims to have helping children affected by drugs become better prepared for kindergarten.
Rocking chairs so that the teachers can have more than one child on their lap.
Laura Lessig is showing me a classroom she's long envisioned. In a space that used to be an abandoned state hospital, she's created an early childhood classroom designed to feel like a home.
All the lights in all the rooms are on dimmers.
As director of Allentown's Community Services for Children, she says that's exactly what kids who've experienced trauma need.
Sometimes we get a 1 or a 2 year old or a 2.5 year old who was introduced to children and youth because a parent was actively using and the child was severely neglected.
Lessig runs a special version of the federal Early Head Start program called Safe Start. It serves children under 3 years old who have been harmed by their parents' substance abuse. The program started as part of a federally funded pilot in 2003, and it's the only early Head Start program in the nation that enrolls students directly from the local county welfare offices.
A lot of the children that we were serving in child welfare and in our early Head Start program were the same children.
Where is Zay-Zay?
Mommy.
Give me that.
Oh, gentle.
Safe Start enrolls 72 Sarah. Infants and toddlers who have had at least 3 adverse childhood experiences, which research shows corresponds with poor outcomes for school and health.
Their brains are really hardwired in the first 3 years of life where the neural pathways are at their densest.
With lots of natural light and soft colors, the facility looks like a typical daycare. But here, everyone is under the supervision of a team of social workers and therapists.
A lot of the children have difficulty with touch. They can have irritability. Sometimes they wander around indiscriminately and don't know where to be. So all that is really part of the trauma that they've endured. And the main focus to mitigate trauma is really relationship building, not only with the child, but with the family.
Safe Start says this whole family approach is key. Most parents of kids in the program struggle with their own mental and emotional needs, in addition to substance abuse. So to encourage stability, the program has an open-door policy for parents. Dana Henry has been working with Safe Start families for over a decade.
So they don't have good role models from their childhood. So by coming here and working with the teachers and the therapeutic family coaches, they can give them resources, model for them, and show them how to be that role model.
Are you all done?
You can't have Johnny's food, you silly goose. Sit down.
There are signs that the program is working. Safe Start reports that by the time they reach preschool, most children have overcome their disabilities. The Allentown School District has not studied or analyzed the outcomes of students from the program, but leaders are very enthusiastic about any early interventions. Jackie Scott is a top district official.
The earlier the intervention, the better. Absolutely the better. I mean, if you're not really identifying needs until, you know, a child is 10 or 11 or 12, you think about the behavior that they have experienced and then the negativity they've experienced because of the behavior. It's just like this swirling tornado for this child.
The extra therapists and small class sizes that Safe Start provides aren't cheap. The program spends about $37,000 per child a year, more than three times the average allocation for early Head Start kids. A growing body of research says these sorts of investments are worth it. But the reach of these programs is relatively small. In 2016, according to federal data, just 7% of children who are eligible for such programs in Pennsylvania had access. Scott hopes these numbers go up. As effects of the opioid crisis and poverty continue, she says Allentown schools would benefit from having more children come into kindergarten ready to learn.
Knowing that Head Start and programs like that are looking at these things is fantastic, because you can have several great things to teach kids strategies. But if it's a struggle at kindergarten or first grade, boy, that's tough.
For Keystone Crossroads, Kyrie Greenberg.
So if there's one gripe residents often have in dealing with city services, it's the sometimes circuitous route to get to the right people. At a recent first-person art story slam, Kelsey Stewart won the night with this tale of her efforts to report an accident.
So as a kid, I never learned how to really ride a bike, and it made me feel massively uncool growing up. And so when I got to Philly as an adult, I decided that I'd give it one more go. And a few days into learning how to ride a bike as an adult, I was pedaling down Washington Ave on my way home from the Pride Parade, and I was feeling really good because for the first time in my life, I was having a really fun time on a bike. And then I turned left down 17th Street, and just immediately a car was behind me. And as it sped past me, the driver rolled down his window and shouted, "You shouldn't be on the road," and then swerved into me, sending me flying. And I take stock of myself, and I'm okay, but my bike isn't. So I ride it, walk it, actually, to my friend Zach's house. And I'm kind of like bemoaning my situation and licking my wounds. And he says, "Listen, Kels, I'm sorry this happened to you. I'm glad you're okay, but you got to get over it because bikers are hit by cars all the time in Philadelphia. And so as a biker, you really need to file a police report so that they have accurate numbers about how often this happens." And I thought, I'm going to do that. And so I called Philly Non-Emergency, but they were closed because it was a Sunday. And I thought, no big deal, I'll call tomorrow at work. And so on my lunch break, I call Non-Emergency and I say, "I'd like to file a police report because I was in a bike accident." And the woman said, "Whoa, a bike accident? That's an emergency. You have to call the emergency number." And I said, "What number is that?" And she said, 911. And so I was like, "No, I can't call 911. This happened yesterday." And she was like, "You got to call 911. And I said, "Please, anything else?" She said, "Well, you could go to a police station and report it there." And so that was my plan. And after work, I went to the nearby police station and I walked in and I said to the guy behind the window, I said, "Hi, I'd like to file a police report. I was in a bike accident." And he said, "Whoa, a bike accident? That's an emergency. You have to call 911. And I was like, "I'm in a police station." And I was like, "Actually, sir, I called Non-Emergency first because the bike accident happened yesterday. And then it said I could file a report here." And then he looked me in the eyes like, "Why are you telling me how to do my job?" And he said, "If you want to file a police report here, you can go sit on that bench right there and call 911. And someone will respond to you here in the police station. Or you can go home and call from there." Now, the thing is, I had happy hour plans, and I didn't want to miss those prices. So I said, "Well, is it okay if I just call 911 tomorrow? And he said, "You can call 911 whenever you want." So I said, "All right, that's the plan." And I went and I had some margaritas. And the next day after work, in the evening, after I made dinner and got kind of cozy, I called the cops. And I said, "I was in a bike accident on Sunday, and I'd like to file a police report." And they sent someone. I was living at 15th and Snyder at the time. And it was dark by the time the sirens came. And I saw them flashing, and I ran down, and there was like a pound on the door, and I opened it. And it wasn't a regular police car. It was like one of those SUV police cars. And they had parked it across the corner. with the lights going, bouncing off the buildings. And then the giant police officer was looking down at me and he said, "So did you call 911? And I'm in like my house sweatsuit. And I was like, "Yes." And he said, "Well, what happened?" And I said, "I was in a bike accident on Sunday." And he said, "Did you call 911 for something that happened 2 days ago?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "Do you know that 911 is for emergencies only?" And I said, "Well, here's the thing, officer. Everybody told me that this was an emergency." And then I went through it. I said, "Listen, I tried really, really hard not to call you. I went through all the hoops, and they all told me, even a policeman told me that I had to call you. And he took all my information, like a lot of information about which police station I had gone to. And I never learned if anything came from it, but I did learn that there's like absolutely no reason to ever say, 'I'll just call 911 tomorrow.'"
That's Kelsey Stewart, an educator and artist who lives in Philadelphia. She was recorded for Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. The next episode airs Sunday night at 8 on WHYY-FM and is also available on podcast. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.